Thanks for joining the podcast with Tamara Gondor. Conversations with everyday innovators that reject status quo, think differently, and make a positive difference in their world. Listen in so you can ignite innovation, influence others, and make an impact too. And now your host, CrossFit addict, knee-high sock lover, and according to her kids, average cook, Tamara Gondor.
Pretty darn excited for today's interview. So let me just give you a little bit of why, and then I'm going to let my guest introduce himself because I think he'll do the best job. So as many of you know, I decided to train for my first Ironman, which is, let's make sure I get this right, Dave, 2.3 mile swim, 112 mile bike ride, and then a marathon, basically, of running.
You were close.
Oh, I was close. Okay, well, I should probably know that before I do it. One of the things I've really come to realize in all this training is that there are a lot of lessons in training that really do apply to life, work, goals, success as well. And as I started digging into this training, all roads really led to this man, Dave Scott, who has one Ironman, who is in the Hall of Fame, who has done incredible things and I think accomplished incredible feats that most of us would just go, wow, like that is just amazing. So Dave, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are? And then I have so many questions for you.
Well, thank you, Tamara. Thank you for having me on your show. And hopefully I can offer some seeds of hope for some of your listeners, and I welcome their questions as well. So, I kind of fell into Ironman, and before the sport even had a name, I did my first triathlon in 1976. So that ages me quite a while back. The first Hawaii Ironman, which wasn't denoted as the world championship, was in 1978. I did an 80. And in 1980, most people didn't know what they were doing. And I just thought, well, this is a race. I'm going to try to race this. And if I fall apart, I do. And that was sort of my debut, and it was covered by Wide World of Sports. And at that time, there were no cable channels, so people got a glimpse of the sport, and they sort of knew me and thought, maybe this is pretty ludicrous. Why'd this guy do this? And but that was my start. And then I ended up racing through the 80s. I won six times during the 80s, and I had three seconds, a second also in the 80s, in 89 and 94, and then kind of finished my Ironman business in 1996.
I love how you say all that stuff. Like, and I won six times, but I just, for listeners, I just want you to know, like, the training is not something you do in a month. It's not off the couch. Like, this is something that is, this is a long haul to get to an Ironman, to get to just one. You've done many and you won six of them, all in Hawaii, right? Is that right?
Yeah, Hawaii is the world championships, and there's Ironman races around the world. So they're on every continent, and there's a combined half Ironman and Ironman, there's 140 races worldwide. So you can pick Ironman races, but sort of the granddaddy or grandmother of all the races is still Kona, still Ironman Hawaii. And that's the one people have to qualify for based on these other races. So it's still the one that people are going after.
Got it. So here's my starting question for you. So motivation is one thing. Motivation is great to get us started in whatever it is we want to succeed in. But to do an Ironman and to do it over and over again takes more than motivation. I think it takes kind of more of an internal drive. So I'm curious, for someone like you, what is that drive for you and how do you find it?
Well, I don't know if it's any different for me and any other person that has aspirations in, you know, other areas of life. I think it's pretty easy to become complacent. And once you become complacent, whatever you're doing, complacency breeds mediocrity. And so I always feel like when people get to a point, it's fine to idle. It's fine to have downtime, easy time, but you should always have your mind and body sort of revved up, ready to do it. And I think a lot of people avoid taking, I'll say, calculated risks. And these risks are really important because it sort of sets the barometer for your mind to say, hey, I can attain these. It's a little seed that you plant. And it also creates a vulnerability because a lot of people say, well, I don't want to do that because I might fail. And it's along with these risks, I think a lot of people have the fear of the unknown and fear of disappointment. And they don't want their peers to know that they've failed. And I think for me, and coming back to your question, Tamara, I had doubt. Sure, I had self-doubt, but I always put myself in this category that I'm going to risk my vulnerability and I'm going to do it again. And I'm going to do it again because I can hopefully better myself. And it really wasn't, the impetus was not necessarily my competitors, that I was the honeybee at these races. I mean, once I won, everyone wanted to knock me off. And so they'd all glom around me. And obviously that provided motivation, but really it was sort of this, it's sort of this internal faith. It has nothing to do with religion. So faith within myself. I always thought, you know, faith breeds the highest probability of success. And if I just kind of keep that, even when I'm failing, but I keep that seed of faith, I'm going to be successful.
I want to ask you a question about something you said, because I think it's really important and powerful. You had said you kind of, people don't put themselves out there because of fear of failure or fear of other people thinking they failed. But I guess the question I would ask around that is what is the definition of failure? Because if I looked at somebody else who put themselves out there and tried it, even if they didn't succeed in whatever it is they were trying, in my mind, they're incredible because they did something I was afraid to do. So that, like, the thing about failure, I think it's so tricky because it's such a subjective thing. So how do you look at that? And how do you kind of advise people who are trying to train to get over that fear that they're going to look stupid or failure, when really it's mostly in their head?
Well, it is in their head. You stated it very well. It's sort of a mindset where people program themselves that I'm not going to succeed.
Yeah.
And fear of success and fear of failure are on this really small pinnacle. So, you know, people can have successes and they may have 10 successes and one failure, and they look at themselves as a failure. You know, you can have all these things going up to it. And, you know, people always talk about, it's kind of a trite saying, but there is some validity to it. You know, enjoy the journey when you're going up. And I think when you're enjoying the journey, for me, Ironman race was always the big race of the year. But many, many times I didn't allow myself to be successful, to acknowledge yourself that, hey, you have succeeded. And so I had great difficulty. Contrary to your question, I didn't always have the answers. And when I had this fear that I was failing, it really manifested into depression. And so I developed this anxiety, and I had depression quite badly. And it was something that I didn't admit for a long time, because most people say, well, Dave Scott, you're a 6-time Ironman champion, you're on top of the world. And I didn't allow myself to sort of relish and recognize those successes along the way. And trying to get back to your question, I think a lot of times when people set goals, they don't think of goals, they think of the overall objective. Like, I have a year-long objective. That's fine. But I think really to be successful and to acknowledge those little steps, you have to have weekly goals. Those can be shared if you choose to share them, or they can be just your little saying to yourself. And I think having these weekly goals, and they can be small little steps, people will all of a sudden savor those successes and they won't fear failing.
First of all, I just want to say thank you for sharing that. And I think it's this interesting quandary that a lot of us are in. And I put myself in this too, where you look at other people who have success that you want and you think everything is great. That's obviously why they're successful. They don't have the anxiety. They obviously don't have the fear. They obviously don't have the dread or whatever, the depression. But those two things are not mutually exclusive. And I think that that's for me and for a lot of people, I think that's a real relief to know that you can be successful and have those things, and you can not succeed and have those things. So you might as well go for it, really, at the end of the day, because it's going to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anxiety obviously can segue into depression. And yeah. I would create this mountain that was insurmountable. Mm. And I had kind of an all or nothing.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to sort of recognize that I didn't need, and this isn't excessive, I didn't need to work out 4 hours a day, which was pretty common. Yeah. I'd swim, bike, run, I'd do strength training, and it was a 4 to 8 hour day. And so anything less than that, I had failed. So if I had other life things that came in, which happens all the time. And if I had set aside, well, I'm going to run 12 miles today and I could only run 8, then I failed.
Yeah.
And so like an alcoholic, the thing that I would switch off is that it was all or nothing. If I couldn't do it the way I wanted to do it, I would go to zero. And so I would fuel myself in a negative way by not doing it. And it was sort of self-inflicted torture. And it's no different than anyone else, but the mindset that allowed me to overcome this. And I saw psychologists, sports psychologists. I said, wow, you know, I'm this Ironman champion, but at times I just felt like I was a floating feather with no course. And I finally kind of got to the resolve that the physical part of what I do is huge. And the physical part controls my mental aptitude. And I have a steadfast rule for everyone. I just say, listen, if you have 20 minutes to exercise in a day, 20 minutes, you write that down. And generally after 20 minutes, you feel better. So 20 minutes allows that morphine-like effect, those endorphins to sort of permeate your brain. And then all of a sudden you have resolve and you don't fear. And you say, gee, it wasn't what I really wanted to do, but it was okay. And it took me years and years and years to get to that point where I had this 20-minute rule and I adhere to it.
You're listening to Conversations with Everyday Innovators on With Tamara Gondor Podcast. Let's take a moment to thank our generous partners that make this possible.
I want to take a moment to talk about my friends at Howdy Puppy. Dogs experience all the same problems as humans when it comes to joint pain, anxiety, digestion, and arthritis. A great way to help our four-legged family members with these ailments is with CBD-infused pet treats. Who doesn't like treats? As you longtime listeners know, my Mastiff Zoe is part of my family, but is getting older and has some anxiety issues when strangers come around. Howdy Puppy CBD dog treats has totally changed her disposition. And I know she feels like her young, energetic, confident self when she gets Howdy Puppy CBD dog treats. There are many CBD-infused dog treats on the market, but the truth is that many of them are overpriced and ineffective. We've looked at dozens of CBD dog treats and found most of them disappointing. Howdy Puppy is among the best brands in the CBD pet business. They deliver consistent quality, and their treats look and taste amazing, according to our dogs, of course. The company makes CBD dog treats in 3 flavors, steak, bacon, and cheese rolls. All of Howdy Puppy CBD treats contain natural ingredients, including high-quality full-spectrum hemp oil, all sourced and made in the USA. Full disclosure, I'm an investor in Howdy Puppy. But before I put my name on the company, I had an independent lab in Denver, Colorado, verify the quality and consistency of their treats. They are truly as advertised. Go online today at howdypuppy.com, link will also be in the show notes, and use promo code Tamara, T-A-M-A-R-A, that's me, to get 20% off the absolute best CBD dog treats on the market. You will not be disappointed. Howdypuppy.com, promo code Tamara. Don't let them suffer needlessly. Let them enjoy life too.
I love it. So I love that for a couple of reasons. One is you're absolutely right. I think movement for 20 minutes always puts you in a better mood. And that's, you know, the research has proven that. But also I think in life goals too, what a great example of like, if I just break it down and do little increments, I'll still get there. We get so focused on everything has to be, whether it's an Ironman or life or work, whatever. And I know I'm guilty of this. Everything has to be all or none. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and ask you about obstacles, because what you are talking about kind of leads me to that question. So external obstacles, wind, the water is choppy. I don't know. There's a bottleneck somewhere in the race. I mean, fill in the blank. You know better than me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You stated it well again. bad conditions,
right? But there's internal and there's external obstacles. So But you have a little bit of a different view on those things. And we were talking about this offline, whatever that was, a couple of weeks ago. And so I'd love to hear that again, your perspective on the obstacles and why you think that kind of bogs people down so much versus kind of how you said you really tackle them.
I had an interview tomorrow before the 1987 race. And I remember vividly, that was the sixth one that I won. And the reporter asked, he said, "Oh, Dave, you seem to really relish bad conditions, violent wind, big waves, extreme hot conditions, no cloud cover whatsoever." And Hawaii can't have all of those, and quite often it does. And I was thinking inside when he asked this question, because I could see it affected the other. It was a press conference with the other athletes I was going to race in a couple of days. And I could see it bothered them just thinking about all those negative things. Said, you know, this is just going to be a wicked day, because now this reporter is reciting probably the worst day that we could possibly have. But it actually, in actuality, it was true. I thought about it for a second before I answered, and I said, "I don't like those conditions at all." I'm thinking this to myself. I like a nice calm day, a little bit of cloud cover, cooler day. But at the same time, I had found, not just from this one question, that the conditions never last for a long time. And I think, let's just, Kona winds are notorious, and it can be big winds, 50 to 60 mile an hour crosswinds, but they never blow for 112 miles in your face. And so when they would come on, and I would do this in training as well. And I, at the time, a lot of my training was in California and in Colorado. Now we had big winds in the Sacramento Valley. And when I get in those winds, if you mentally fight them and then you physically show how it's tormenting you, you clench your fist, you grit your teeth, right, your upper traps are tight, your stomach's locked up, you're not pedaling smooth circles or whatever it is, you're slowing down. Right. You've really failed, because you haven't allowed yourself to be successful in those types of conditions. So I would always look at it, sort of a similar answer to Jeff. It was short term. And how can I relax in that period to overcome those conditions? And so I answered the reporter, coming back to the questions. I basically said, I don't mind those conditions. I was basically saying, it doesn't bother me. I don't see them. And I didn't want to sound like I was arrogant. I said, I don't really mind those conditions. It probably will be rough and windy tomorrow. And that just kind of decimated about 95% of the competitors, thinking, oh, Dave Scott really likes these conditions. He's abnormal. You know, why is this guy thinking this? But the truthful side of it is, it is really to control that behavioral pattern, because it's a stress. And the stress, when you have that, when you exercise or when you're thinking about something, you can certainly, in exercise, you can produce adrenaline, and adrenaline is good for short term, but not long term. And you can also produce cortisol, and those cortisol levels go up, and they manifest really in long term destruction. Cortisol goes up, and that's a favorable thing. But if you allow it to really heighten over time with the conditions that you describe, it can wreck you.
I'm kind of gathering two really important insights that I really want the Launch Street community to pay attention to. One is, you're letting the external obstacles dictate how you behave or how you perform. Of course, some wind's going to slow you down. Of course, right? Like, choppy is choppy. But I think all too often we give into the external conditions versus pushing through them and knowing that they're going to be short term. And the other thing I'd say is that you said is exactly what I just said. It's short term. So that's not going to last forever. And frankly, even if the wind lasted for the entire Ironman, you'll be done at some point. This is not like forever. So I know that sounds very callous, because it's hours and hours. But, and I also think that a lot of us, and I'm guilty of this, we look at those external conditions and we worry about them before they even happen, or in the future of them happening. So I'll just use the wind as the easiest example. You're on your bike, it gets a little windy, and then your brain just goes, oh shit. Yeah. Like, I'm going to spend an entire ride in the wind. You don't know that. But now you're panicked, not just about the moment you're in, but about 2 hours down the road that hasn't even happened yet. And that, to your point with cortisol, that's got to take so much mental and physical energy out of your performance when you do that.
Yeah, it happens to us, not just racing, but it certainly does during a race if you let it heighten and overcome you. I think, you know, I hear a lot of athletes or people that are going into a corporate meeting, and they have a plan. We all have a plan, and we want that script to play out. And so, yeah, I mean, you're going to do your Ironman. You're going to have a plan on what you're capable of doing. Yeah, no, and I'll follow you very closely. That'll be fun tomorrow, and I can interview you after you're done. So, no, that'll be good. We can tell all your lies.
Now the pressure's on.
Yeah, the pressure is on. But I think a lot of times when we have a plan, that script never plays out. And so one of the things that you kind of alluded to and what I followed always is to react and respond and be spontaneous to the moment and be adaptable. And I think the spontaneity is what people lose because they become too rigid. If you're planning on going into a meeting, you know that a couple of people are just rattlesnakes in the meeting, and you've already programmed that, and you know that you're not going to get on the good side of them. Well, that's probably going to be the outcome. When I was coaching athletes, and I have been, and I still do, I coach my swim group today. I've had athletes that I've had in my group that I do not like, and they're abrasive. They've got rugged, rough personalities. And my first response is, don't let them win. I want to win. And so how do I win them? And it's not with sugarcoating them. It's just being very candid. My candor always has a tendency to kill me a little bit, but at the same time, I want them to be on my side. I don't want them to have a fence or to push back or a preconceived notion about Dave Scott. And one of the things that really helped me sort of late in my career, when I was 38, plus, I decided to do the Ironman when I was 40. That was 1994. And at that time, there wasn't professional athletes really in any sport that were 40 years old that were competitive. And I had been out of triathlon almost 5 years. I'd kind of dabbled in some sort of recreational triathlons, but I hadn't competed with the big boys in the big league. And I went to a friend of mine who was an undergraduate with me. He was now teaching. He had his doctorate at CU Boulder, and his name happened to be Jeff. And he said, hey, Dave, why don't you come in? And I know you got Ironman coming up. You're 40. You've got a lot of publicity on this. I'm sure you feel a lot of pressure. You haven't raced in 5 years. And the last time you raced was with Mark Allen, and you lost. So, you know, basically, you know, why are you doing this? But let's unravel that. He told me a couple things, and I'll get to my point quickly. He said, I want you to write down on the right side of the paper what you should do. And so I have this huge list. My two boys were born during that five-year period, 89 and the latter part of 90, 15 months apart. So all of a sudden I had my two boys, loved them to pieces, but they were a distraction for, okay, I got this Ironman thing and I'm the, you know, I was the guy for a while. And I'm sure that I still have this bullseye on me. So I wrote this should list and it was quite long. He said, I'm gonna give you 10 or 15 minutes to write this down. And then he said, on the left-hand side of the paper, write down what you want to do. Well, I had about three things. The want to do was real fast. You know, I said, well, I wanna be a good father. At the time I was happily married. I said, I wanna be a good husband and I wanna race fast. I want to race to my potential. And, you know, whether those are those three, pretty darn close. And the should have was this long list. Like, you got to get back to this. Business-wise, I got to do this. And all of a sudden, it just mentally unraveled me. And he goes, I want you to take a look at that should list. And he said, what can you take responsibility for? And just tell whomever or decide within yourself that you're going to put this off because you've got this big event coming up. And I'm going to get back to you. It wasn't a zero. And it became really simple. I said, well, I can take that should list and I can cut it down to about one thing. So he said, well, do that. And he said, on the want list, this is what you want to do. Remind yourself of these three things. And then he kind of flipped it to the race. He said, what do you really want to do in the race? And I said, you know, I just want to control my own potential, push my destiny button, whatever that is, and allow myself to just supersede maybe the top goal that I envisioned. And that's how I looked at those races. He added one more element. And I've told this with my athletes all the time, and we've kind of alluded to this tomorrow. He said a very simple thing. When you're in that race, and it comes back to the spontaneity comment, he said, do what you can do at the moment. In other words, be present. Do what you can do at the moment. And I know, and I use it all the time because it pertains to, you know, your listeners and anyone else that says, hey, Dave, I don't exercise. You're this, you know, super guy who does all this exercise. I just want to start. And I always tell them, don't procrastinate. Allocate the time, write it down, do what you can do at the moment. And just like you, Tamara, that did the 30-minute ride, you only had 30 minutes, but it does provide that seed of great psychological, emotional uplift that you have.
Well, and I think that advice is so important in a lot of ways in life about being present and not letting the past or the future decide how you perform in the moment. And I think it's very easy to the future is actually more baggage than the past for a lot of us, because it's what could happen, what could go wrong, right? Like, it's all that stuff. And I love that. And I want to actually parlay that into a question about mental, I don't know if it's mental toughness, but one of the things that I've heard you talk about in interviews is, you know, you get into the valleys, the mental, not your body, not, oh, my back hurts on the bike, but like, you know, the mental places of, well, all of it. So I don't want to put words in your mouth of what your mental place is. I know mine is rough. I can tell you that. And it's demoralizing, and it's in that place where you're sure you can't win or you can't finish even. It's not even win at that point. It's where you just don't think you have it in you no matter what you did. And to what you said earlier, your plan falls apart on you usually. And was it Mike Tyson that said everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face? And I feel like that's life and kind of what you were saying, but
very apropos.
Yeah. Right. What do you do to get out of the valleys that, I mean, when you're doing an Ironman, I mean, for someone like me, this is going to be a 17-hour endeavor. You're a lot faster, but it's a long time. And, you know, the race of life is a long time. So what do you do to get out of that?
Reduce the amount of time, the worry time. And you just alluded to it tomorrow. You're looking in the future. You're forecasting things aren't going well, how bad you're doing, and therefore it's going to be catastrophic at the end. And how are you going to get out of this? And how are you going to explain this to your friends and family? And then I felt pressure from the journalists that were covering it. And, you know, you stuck your neck on the line, Dave, and you're just doing so poorly. And those thoughts just race through you. Once you have this self-doubt, and you kind of lose this faith within yourself, and all of a sudden the negative locomotion machine just rolls over the top of you. Yeah, and I think there's kind of a misstatement when people say, oh, you always have to remain optimistic. And it has this rosy sort of connotation to it. I don't mind people saying, gee, I'm an optimistic person. I'm always looking for the good in something. But I always talk about realistic optimism. And realistic optimism allows you to get out of these valleys per your question. And I'll use an example tomorrow. The last Ironman I did, and I'm never introduced in a public forum. Oh, Dave's 6-time Ironman champion. That's usually they stop there. And he also had 3 seconds. Well, that's okay. But they would never say, oh, by the way, he got fifth. And the last race I did was 1996. And people have asked me, you know, what was my greatest race? And I say 1996. And they say, well, I didn't even know you raced then. I said, well, I got fifth place. And I'll sort of glide through this. In 94, I was 40. I got second. And I thought I could win that race. In 1995, I dropped a weight in the gym on my toe and broke my toe. And so I was out of that race. And that wasn't wise. And then 96, I came back. Now I'm 42. Quietly, I thought I could win the race. When the gun went off, I felt good. And I was optimistic. And I was realistic on how I could push myself. But I didn't have a good marathon coming off the bike in 1994. And I said, I'm going to run fast in this race. And if I have to win it on the run, I know I can do that. And it was this sort of internal confidence that I sort of instilled in myself. I had the worst swim of my life ever. And I came out of the water way behind. I knew the people that I was with. I said, I should be up there about 300 meters. And I'm with this sea of piranhas in the swim. And this person's too slow. Why am I swimming with them? I couldn't get out of it. But I said, don't worry. I got on the bike and I said, I'm going to take off on the bike. And at about 9 miles, the press truck went by me. I was well behind the leaders. And they obviously knew who I was, and I knew a lot of the people in the press. The press truck slowed down. There's probably 30, 40 people on this big truck that's open air. And I could see a lot of the faces of people that have interviewed me, and they had these sort of forlorn looks like, oh, Dave, you're 42. What are you doing? Yeah, I should be having a glass of wine on the side or margarita or something. And they zoomed off up to the leaders. And that kind of set the tone for me. Like I said, I've started out poorly. I have the plan, which you alluded to, tomorrow. And the plan wasn't in place on the swim. I didn't prevail on that. Now I'm on the bike, but I'm going to really take off. Well, that just started this cascading effect of negativity. And I couldn't get out of it. So now I'm at 15 miles and I just said, my legs feel rugged. I wasn't breathing hard. I just felt like muscularly I was really laboring. And I kind of had this moment for a long time that it was, woe is me. This shouldn't be happening to me. You know, I'm better than this. Exactly. And I allowed that to just put this wet wool blanket over the top of me. And I couldn't get out of it. And finally, as you recited, the bike is 112 miles. At about 85 miles, so I'm 3 hours and 40 something minutes into the ride. And I finally said, I am way back. I don't know what place I was in. I thought I was in 50th place, never been in that position before in the world championships. But I said to myself, I have an opportunity, And now this optimism prevailed to run the marathon. I get to run the marathon. A marathon's a long run, and I get to run this, and I'm going to run it fast, because that was my plan before. But now I reignited this internal fire. And so I saw some of my family and friends from around mile 90 all the way to the finish where they were out on the course. I think they'd almost given up on me, but not entirely. They knew I was like a deranged Wolverine at times, where I could just, you know, dig out of the trenches and say, I'm going to go after it. You know, I'm not going to be fatigued at any moment. So that, I think they still had hope that I would do well. I hollered at him. I said, tell me where number 10 is. I wanted to know where the 10th place man. I said, this isn't going to look good on my resume, but if I can move from wherever I am right now up to 10th place in the top 10, this is going to be an amazing day. So I got off the bike not knowing where I was, and never really knew until the next day, but I kept passing people and I was running magnificently for me. I was running with this open mind. And I think what changed was it took the entire swim and bike to get out of this just horrible pit, this valley where I just couldn't draw myself out. I wasn't doing what I could do at the moment. Now I was on the run and I was passing people, and at mile 16 or 17, I caught the 10th place person. And I said, I got to keep going. I feel great. And at mile 21, I was able to catch the 5th guy. And I just ran, you know, if the run was not 26 miles, but maybe 36 miles, I might have been able to catch the other ones. But that particular day, coming in 5th and getting off the bike in 26th, I allowed myself to wallow in this valley, this mucky valley of mental demise. And it took me a long time. I said, golly, I'm much stronger than this. But when I look at the greatest race that I've ever done, that was it.
So there's a couple really admirable things about that, Dave, that I have to say. One is, those valleys can be short and long, depending on what you're dealing with, Ironman or on a daily basis with kids, family, work. But I think there's two cool, I'll just listen to my own podcast later. I was like, I wish I was taking notes, not holding my computer, but I'll do that later. One is, you set a goal that you could go after that was big, but attainable for you. So the goal, right, to catch up with that 10th person gives you something that when you're in that valley that can help pull you out. Cause you're like, okay, if I could do that, then I've had a huge day because I've given it my all. I have achieved, you know, I've closed a gap that was huge. So I think there's a lot of value in setting a goal that is attainable, but big. It may not have been the end goal you were going for to begin with, but it's big. Yeah. The other thing I'd say that's really admirable about it is turning that obstacle into an opportunity. So that kind of mindset of, how lucky am I that I get to try to catch up with this guy on the run. And how lucky am I that I get to crush the run versus, oh my God, two of the three events are done. And now I'm like, forget it. I'm just going to coast my way in, yogging, as I would say. I'm going to yog my way in. But I think those are both very cool and more than cool. I think they're very admirable pieces of advice that to really pay attention to, because I think when we're in the valley, it's again, and I hear a lot in what you're saying, this theme of like not making it all or none about these bite size, these chunks, but in a really powerful way. But that really does help us get out of it of like, if I can just get to here, right, then I know I can keep going and I can keep going. Yeah. I didn't have a question there. I just wanted to say that.
No, it's a very good statement. I mean, it was a huge obstacle. It was a mental obstacle. And physically, I had ridden much, much faster in thousands of train rides. And I just couldn't get my legs. They were tired. In hindsight, I probably did too much on the bike. They just didn't perform. And I had some of my competitors go by me, sort of pulling me along. Come on, Dave, go with me. And I just said, you know, I can't, I'm tired. And it was no different than a train ride. But I had always felt that this obstacle, as you just stated, could be an opportunity. And then all of a sudden, my optimism, which I have, and I'm real about it, just soared. And it wasn't about, you know, I didn't have a vendetta about catching X person. You know, I knew there were a lot of my fellow competitors ahead of me. Most of them were quite a bit younger than me, but I, you know, admired them and knew them. And it really wasn't about, I have to beat that person. It was just, how hard can I push myself? And this outcome is going to be fantastic because I'll drive myself to my utmost potential.
Well, and the 10th person isn't Greg, whoever Greg is, you know, it is a ranking. You know, it's a totally different mindset. Just on all of that, I just want to say, because I've already taken your advice, since you and I was fortunate enough to talk to you offline kind of before the podcast. One is, it was super windy the other day while I was biking, and it made me think of you and the obstacle stuff. And I started smiling on the bike, And I was laughing as like I was being pushed around. But normally that would have panicked me. I also laughed because it was freezing cold. So the spit like dried on my teeth and was like, it's just so funny.
You can't be glamorous all the time.
No. But it was like a little game. And, you know, I hear you talking about it. It's kind of all these little games you play to get out and to make the ownership inside. Yesterday when I was swimming, I think I told you I wanted to go a mile to make sure that I could even do it because I hadn't done that yet ever. I hadn't really gone more than like 35 minutes. And the little game in my head was, could I stay in the pool longer than the people, other people? I didn't know them. I didn't talk to them. That doesn't matter. What mattered is the minute they got out of the pool before me, I was like, yes, nailed it. I'm winning the day.
Yeah,
I was slower than everybody. Like none of that mattered, my little head games. But you know, I hear you talk about that and kind of those head games that come up of how you get yourself to the next place. But you're so right. They're short term, and all those little short terms stack up to the bigger wins.
Yeah. Those little ones are huge. And again, I didn't really savor those or recognize those, but that's how I trained. When I first started training for Ironman, there was no one else that I could play with. I had a close friend who was a physician, and he would come around the weekends, and you know, we'd sort of play these tag, you know, Mike, you turn around early, you got 5 miles lead on me on the bike. I'm going to see if I can catch you. And we would have these magnificent races all by ourselves. And sometimes it would come down to the last mile where I would catch him or I wouldn't. And it was just this crazy game. And to motivate myself now is no different than what you just said in the pool. I do this all the time. And if I see someone ahead of me on the bike, I say, can I close the gap by X miles? Maybe I can get them by the city line. You know, I play these crazy games with myself, but it allows me to be relaxed and calm, and it keeps me hungry. And I think where people say, oh, I'm just not going to do that. And that's fine. You know, if you choose just to exercise, it's very comfortable. It's conversation paced, and that makes you feel good. I'm perfectly with you. But I think it's sometimes important, and it may not manifest with exercise, where you take yourself out of that guarded area. And I think too many people are guarded, and that guarded feeling, I always feel like, wow, you don't really know what your capabilities are. You don't really know what your potential is. And how do you envision yourself sort of moving forward? So I always feel that everyone has a skill, a gift, and exploit that. And then on the other side, things that you aren't very good at, don't run away from them. Don't hide from your weaknesses. Challenge yourself by doing those weaknesses. And you may fumble along, maybe in the bottom 4% of whatever it is, but keep challenging yourself. I'll use an example. I'm in my mid-60s, and I look at a lot of 60-year-old men and women, 70-year-olds, and I'm crazy about posture and strength and head position and balance. And so I pick on balance. I have pretty good balance because I do it all the time. So when I have camps or I teach people and I get a 30-year-old guy who's got, you know, great looking quads and beautiful muscles, and I say, let's stand on one foot and pick this dime up off the floor, and this guy's wobbling all over the planet. You know, at the same time, I'm not doing it just to exploit my ego, but it really is just to kind of recognize, well, you're not very good at this. Let's practice this. Your balance, which becomes more apparent as you age in every decade, work on it. Don't let it go on a decline.
So here's my last question for you, and I'll preface it with a very quick story. So I do CrossFit. I'm taking a break, obviously, right now to do Ironman, but I've done it for 6 or 7 years. Transformed my life. It's one of my favorite things. But I have a girlfriend in CrossFit who's a dear, dear friend. And she and I are about the same in terms of like weights, heavy, right? It's same age group. And we're like 20 years older than everybody else in class. And we used to have this running joke when we were lifting where we would take half kilos and we would put them on the ends just to beat the other person by 1 kilo. And other people in the class thought we were mean for doing that to each other.
But awesome.
Yeah, we knew that this was our way of pushing ourselves and each other. And it was very friendly between us. And we're both highly competitive people. We both wanted to win. If there was a real competition, like we were at it once that, you know, buzzer went off. But in daily life, it pushed us both, even though other people were probably horrified by our behavior. You've got this whole Iron Wars with Mark Allen, which, you know, you got, and I've seen as I was doing research for this, I found these incredible interviews with you two and just, you know, the press was all over it. You guys were neck and neck in races, like literally side by side. But you have a very, I'd say, enlightened view on competition. So to close out our podcast, will you share that? Because I think life is a game and I think there's a lot of competition in life and most of us let that hold us back, but you see it a little differently.
Again, I'll use a word that I've shared. It's an opportunity. And so I never looked at competition as an anvil on my shoulder. I knew going into Ironman and Mark Allen was my most fierce competitor. We had many, many battles together, that he would be ready. And I had won 6 before he had won 1. And we had this battle in 1989. And I knew it was going to be probably what has now been a historic battle. And we were ferocious competitors when we would line up, but there was also mutual respect and admiration. And I don't really see that in some of the sports. I see this sort of caustic, nasty attitude. I think you use competition in a lot of different ways, whether it's business or whether it's athletic realm, as an asset. And I always thought Mark was an asset to me because he was going to bring out the best performance in me. I had this internal pride that I could push myself. And did I need Mark? No, not really. But at the same time, he was a, you know, I think he was a plus to my performance. And I think what gets skewed in life and skewed in competition, and you just kind of alluded to it, you put that half kilo plate on the outside. So someone would notice that you kind of boosted the bar a bit. I think it's the right thing. I think it's always the right thing. And one of the to try to answer your questions, and it's sort of my coaching philosophy. And when I put a program out, I see a lot of coaches that will write out a program and the athlete knows exactly what it is. They know the workloads, they know the heart rate or the power or whatever, the speed, whatever they're trying to do. And for example, and I'll use this today, in my swim group, quite often I keep them guessing, and keeping them guessing keeps them hungry. It makes them a little bit anxious because they don't know what's coming up. And quite often when if they've gone through half of the workout, which they did today, and I said, well, there's three main segments. They've done two plus. And I say, okay, we've got the third one. And quite often I'll tag something on the end. So when they're breathing hard, they're fatigued, and I come in there with a deadpan poker face and I say, well, we got this one little effort on the end. And I can see them moan and groan. But at the same time, I'll just say, now I want you to just think about what you're capable of doing. And I think when people look at their capabilities as this realistic optimism, they measure the bar higher than what they've done. And so the example I just gave in the pool is I said, okay, we're going to do this. I let them think about it for about 20 seconds. Their first reaction is, oh no, this is going to be too uncomfortable. It's too hard. I'm really tired. And I switch it around and I say, well, I want you to maintain good stroke integrity and I want you to go as hard as you can. And when I leave it, go as hard as you can. All of a sudden, I have everyone that's on my side, but they have to turn on that switch in their brain that says, hey, I can do this. It's not just for Dave because he's my coach. I can do this. And so when they finish it and they're completely smashed and their arms are dead and they're breathing hard, they feel good about themselves tomorrow. And that's the whole point.
Yeah. Well, I think I was thinking this as you were sharing the earlier story too. There's a lot of satisfaction, not in just building your strength, but I'm a big believer of leveraging your strengths in life, but more so in pushing through the challenging things. I think that's way more satisfying. There's a lot more glory in that than doing what you already know you can do easily. So yeah, Dave, this was phenomenal. I said I could keep going, but we're out of time. So
we'll set up another one, maybe pre-race for you tomorrow. Yeah. Race. So
well, I can't thank you enough. This was incredibly insightful. I know the people on got a lot, and I'm looking forward to releasing this to the public. But I think your story is a really powerful one, and I just want to remind the listeners that I have no doubt you were all doing this. But those lessons apply in so many places in our lives, not just Ironman or a 5K race or, you know, kind of one of those. It's everything. And so, Dave, you're incredibly impressive. Thank you for sharing your insights. Yeah, this was great.
You're insightful, Tamara. So thanks for having me again.
Congratulations. By listening to this podcast, you took another step towards becoming an everyday innovator. To leap forward, visit www.gotolaunchstreet.com and take the Innovation Quotient Edge Assessment to discover your unique everyday innovator style and access the Everyday Innovator Digital Magazine for the top tools, insights, and inspiration at your fingertips 24/7. Tamara will be back with another Everyday Innovator Conversation soon. In the meantime, if you got a nugget of value out of this podcast, let Tamara know by leaving a 5-star review and comment. Your review equals more guests, more listens, bigger impact. Until next time.